from the Star Reynolds Sports Desk, your 950 KJR Sports Headlines.
Venue Kings, our friends, brings you the updates here at 3 o'clock. The Huskies beat down by Stanford last night, 79-61. The Dogs host last place Cal on Sunday. In the NBA, LeBron and Kevin Durant have been named captains for the 2021 All-Star Game. They will conduct an All-Star Draft on March the 4th. LeBron, the first player in history to be voted as an All-Star starter for 17 straight seasons. And former Mercer Island star Quinn Snyder has earned a spot as the head coach of Team LeBron as the Jazz hold the league's best record. O'Day's Paolo Banchero has been named one of five finalists for the Naismith High School Trophy for the National Boys Basketball Player of the Year. The award will be announced March 9th. Nathan Hale's Michael Porter Jr. won the award in 2017. And the NCAA will allow up to a 25% capacity for the men's basketball tournament, including the Final Four. Let's get started on a Friday, shall we?
And here we go.
And now, two goofy, wacko, out-of-touch homers.
Just brutal radio. Just horrible.
Live.
41 yards.
From Elliott Bay.
Can you feel it now?
Hey, Seattle.
This is Softy and Dick.
Here we go on a Friday. It's Friday already. That's why I love starting my first show of the week, Hugh. I love starting it on a Wednesday. You know, you get back from vacation like midweek, because Friday just, boom, comes like that when you start your work week on a Wednesday. So here we are. Hugh Millen is back with us. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, Dick.
We're doing good. I was talking to Ian in the last segment about the 4 hours of basketball that I watched last night, the 2 hours of Gonzaga followed by the 2 hours of Washington. And I made a tweet, and sometimes we all tweet impulsively. I know you don't because you don't tweet, but at times we tweet impulsively, and usually that's a bad thing when you tweet impulsively. So I picked up my phone last night, was going to make an impulsive tweet about Gonzaga sometime during the late stages of the first half of that game when they had like 51 points with like 3 minutes left to go in the first half against St. Mary's. And I decided, okay, let's pause for a second. Let's breathe for a second, and let's think about this before you tweet this. And I decided after about 3 or 4 minutes of thinking about what I was going to tweet that I was still going to tweet it. So I said, the Zags are one of the most polished, complete offensive teams I've seen in many, many years, maybe ever. And I put that out there, and someone responded to me right away with a link, and I'm glad they did this. It was from The Athletic. And The Athletic cited KenPom, who we've all heard of. His efficiency ratings are now, heck, even being used by the West Coast Conference to determine seeding. And he is like the number one guru of all things college basketball ranking and has been so for about 25 years. He's been rating teams since the late 90s. And Gonzaga's rating as of right now, Hugh, as a basketball team, and I was just mentioning their offense, but as a basketball team overall, he has them rated as a 38.38 using his metrics. To put that in perspective, there have been two teams ever in his rankings over a 40, the 99 Duke team and the 2001 Duke team. There have been two other teams that have been 38 or more, Anthony Davis in 2015 Kentucky and 2013 Florida. So Gonzaga right now is in the rarefied air as one of only five teams. We're not just talking about offense. We're talking about complete teams in the KenPom era over the last 25 years. And they play basketball in our state. Whether you like them or not, they are here. This is their best team ever. And I was just thinking about the fact that they've got potentially five NBA players on their team that are all bought into this notion that if you share the ball with your teammates and it touches the hands of four, five, six, seven players over a course of a possession, that you actually have a better chance of scoring and beating a defense than if you just dribble and cross over and shoot.
Yeah.
And then you spend 2 hours watching Washington basketball. And Softy, you know, always plays that drop. You know, is your partner a Husky fan or a Zag fan? Hey, I bleed purple and gold. You know I do. Softy knows I do. I always will. But when it comes to basketball, my number one sport of passion, my number one sport of expertise, you know what I'm a fan of? I'm a fan of executing. I'm a fan of instincts. I'm a fan of advanced level strategies, advanced level tactics. I'm a fan of basketball played the right way. And Gonzaga does it, and Washington doesn't. So for me, it's not a Gonzaga versus Washington thing like Softy wants to make it out to be. It's a beautiful basketball versus sloppy basketball thing. And, and I know you've watched some Huskies this year. You've watched a bit of Gonzaga this year. And it's just, it's like watching two different sports, man. It's unbelievable.
Well, I've got a good friend who plays for St. Mary's, a kid I coached in out of Mount Si High School here locally.
Right.
And so, you know, so I, you know, I take interest there now more than ever. I can recall vividly the 1976 game for the title between Indiana and Michigan with Indiana, Kent Benson and Wilkerson and Quinn. Some of the names kind of escape me, but that's the last undefeated team. And I think that when you listen to Roy Williams at North Carolina say, hey, these guys should not be beaten. I mean, that's Roy Williams saying that about Gonzaga. I mean, I don't know what the details are of those matrix that you just described, but this is a team in Gonzaga that is arguably the greatest team in transition ever. I mean, you've got team not, you know, their ability to get out and run. They got five guys who can run the court, who can shoot the three, who are very instinctive, high IQ guys that are selfless. I mean, even Suggs, a guy who, you know, willing to be a 13-5-5 player that you know, just to get that kind of buy-in. You said the word buy-in, and for and it's not just on the fast break, but just on a made basket. They've got the ball in the hoop in 4 seconds. Mm-hmm. So this is a team that rivals any team certainly that I've ever seen, and people that are learned. This for, as a transition team is as good as you've ever seen in college basketball ever.
I'm thinking about as I'm watching those games. I'm thinking about what are the major differences between, throw out talent for a second, and what are the major differences between watching Gonzaga play basketball and watching Washington play basketball, or really, and I don't just want to single out Washington. There's a ton of basketball teams in America that play like Washington. And one is reading of the defenses, I think, is the biggest difference. I mean, Washington, there's no reading of defense on Washington. It's just like, I'm going to put my head down and just go until somebody stops me, and then I'm just going to rise and try to shoot over somebody. I mean, that's the extent, for the most part, of how Washington reads defenses. Shot selection, which kind of partners up with the first. And then just a devotion to the fundamentals and running an offense. Running an offense to get, don't take the good shot, pass up the good shot for the great shot. And so many teams just refuse to pass up the good shot for the great shot because A, they want to get theirs, or B, it's just the easy thing to do. Oh, one pass, I got a good shot. It's the easy thing to do. I'm going to take the good shot when 2-3 more passes and a back cut would have gotten you a wide open layup. And, you know, you watch that game. Gonzaga had 73 points with 10 minutes left to go in the game. 73 in a 40-minute game. Washington had 36 with 10 minutes left to go. Now, different teams they were playing, but how much were they really different? Stanford was only 10 spots ahead of St. Mary's in the KenPom rating, so it's not like they were playing that much of a different basketball team. Honestly.
Yeah, and well, the Huskies are a mess. And I mean, you just defensively, you look at how they're built to be a team that wants to play 94 feet of man to man, right? And yet they've got a coach that is a disciple of that zone, so they don't have the length to defend the corners or the top. They don't have the communication. I mean, they got bailed out with Matisse Thybulle in year one. It made that defense work, and so now they don't have the personnel to make that work. And then offensively, they got Kwadi Green's got 96 attempts, 3-point attempts. He's at 31%. Eric Stevenson has 94 attempts. He's at 32%. And then Hamir Wright, he's third with 78 three attempts at 24%. They had a game this year where he was 0 for 7 in the first half, and he comes into the game at 24%. Now, come on, that's coaching by anybody's definition. Now, you coach high school basketball. You're not going to let a guy shoot who's a 24% or coming into the game, let him be 0 for 7. You can't let that happen in the first half. So I think that, you know, they've only get their chances of turning this around. They got one guy in the class coming in for next year. Here locally, we've got five guys in the ESPN top 75, and four of them are going to schools: Kentucky, going to Duke, going to Gonzaga, going to Arizona. I mean, that's like the who's who. And you got Will Conroy on the staff who he's hired to get those guys. And so you get one guy locally out of them and arguably the least desirable of them. And so and you're only getting one recruit. So I just think defensively, offensively, buy-in, everything. It's just almost feels like it's rock bottom. Now, I know you can always get worse, but it feels like there's just no end in sight.
Well, the differences that I'm talking about and what you're talking about, you're right. I mean, they're not necessarily talent-based differences. They're coaching differences. Now, maybe I'm not going to put the entire load on Mike Hopkins' shoulders right now because this is obviously a difficult year. Maybe this team is just a harder team to get through. I'm sure you've had teams that you've coached. I've certainly have teams that I've coached where some of them are just harder to get the message across to other than others. I mean, I've had teams where I tell them once and it just happens. It just clicks and then I can move on to the next thing. Other teams I've had, you tell them five times and you may get 25% improvement on it. And maybe this is just that type of team. I mean, Hop is going to let us know whether he should keep his job or not based upon what happens between really the day this season ends, because this season's a throwaway at this point. The day this season ends, which how does he build his team for next year, which you mentioned, I mean, other than Jackson Grant, right as of now, nobody else is coming in. I'm sure other transfers will come in. How he builds his team from March 1st, 2021 to the end of whenever the 2021-2022 season ends. That's how he's going to let us know. And he's either going to let us know that he is the right man for the job because that we will see a huge spike in production over the next 12 months, or we will see little to no spike over production. And I'm just going to kind of leave it at that as far as whether Hop is going to remain the coach here. He's going to show us.
Yeah, and you're in year four, so if you're not getting buy-in and there's a disconnect between the type of player that you're recruiting and the type of scheme that you want to play. I mean, you know, you saw some man-to-man last night that's almost like an admitting like, whoa, this isn't working, you know, but you look at the roster, they're not comprised to right. play the zone that they want to play. So, I think it's I don't want to say it's fascinating, but it's dismaying after Hopkins in year two went 27-9, you know, made the tournament. And then now it's just been, you know, unfortunately, you know, more grim the more you watch it. Meanwhile, as you said, Gonzaga probably has their best year. And, I would say if you go back to when Villanova beat North Carolina in the title game and North Carolina, you know how Roy Williams wants to get out and run, right? And the way Villanova, they sent three guys back and they said, we are not going to get beat in transition. And in that game, North Carolina had like literally like 2 points in transition the entire championship game. Villanova pulled the upset. Somebody's going to have to, I don't know if it's maybe a physical team like a West Virginia or, you know, I know Baylor wants to get up inside you. You know, that would be the type of team, but they could steal a page from what Villanova did against North Carolina and said, you've got to stop these guys in transition. They're so deadly. This is a team in Gonzaga that scored 98 points against Virginia, arguably the best defensive team in college basketball. And the next closest to Virginia, it's like 30 points less that they allowed to Notre Dame. They scored 98 on Virginia. Think of that. So
that's unbelievable.
So yeah, these guys are Titans, and regardless of how you feel about them, where your loyalties might be, a lot of people on this side of the state hate Gonzaga. You know, they're not the up. You know, it's not the Casey Calvary Gonzaga, right?
Yeah.
And so, but they have a chance to do what hasn't been done since 1976. And that's insane. Remember, UNLV, that 91 team, they got stunned by Duke in the championship. We have not seen an undefeated team. And here you got the likes of Roy Williams saying we might see it.
Shil Kapadia will join us from The Athletic. Coming up next, we'll switch our focus back to the NFL. Dick Fain, it's the Softy and Dick Show with Hugh Breedlove Millen on 950 KJ.
All in one app.
Now back to Softy and Dick on your home for March Madness and the Final Four. Seattle's Sports Radio 950, KJR.
Softy and Dick without the soft one, but with Hugh Breedlove Millen and joined by a guy that has just taken off. You know, he is just leaving us local yokels in the dust. He's taking off for bigger and better things. National writer for The Athletic, Sheil Kapadia joins us. How you doing, man?
Doing well, guys. How you doing?
We're doing fantastic. And you are too. You're on a heater. I was joking with Ian about a half an hour ago that, you know, you put out your 10 bold predictions for the 2021 offseason, and that was a week ago today, and number 2 on your list of 10 was the Eagles will trade Carson Wentz to the Colts. So look out, man. You are 1 for 1. What gave you that that premonition that that's where Carson Wentz was going to go?
You throw a bunch of stuff against the wall, and eventually after like a decade, something sticks. So that's what I'll credit it to. You know, I think it was pretty obvious that the Eagles were going to trade Carson Wentz. You don't sort of just dangle your franchise quarterback out there like that if you're just listening or just taking calls. So, you know, I think a couple of weeks ago it was pretty clear he was going somewhere, and then it was just a matter of where is he going to go. And it's such an interesting offseason in terms of QB movement, but the Colts were like the one team that they didn't even have a real starter on the roster. So you knew they had to do something. Obviously, they have the Frank Reich connection with Carson Wentz, and that just kind of made sense. And so finally got done after a couple of weeks, I think, of negotiating between the two sides.
You mentioned the quarterback movement, and I agree with you. I can't remember a year like this. Jared Goff, Matthew Stafford, Carson Wentz. Now, Deshaun Watson as yet does not have a home for his apparent desire to be moved. What's the latest as far as you know on that front?
Yeah, I think the Texans are holding. I think they're doing the right thing. This may be the only right thing they're doing, but I think they're doing the right thing, really trying to make it work with Deshaun Watson. I mean, a guy his age on a contract like that, that is somebody you want to keep or you're going to set your franchise back. But really, I think what it comes down to is Deshaun Watson so upset with the organization that he's going to be willing to, like, sit out games in September. And that's something that the Texans have to get a good read on here, really in the immediate future, because if it reaches a point where they say, you know what, he is actually willing to sit out games, we've tried everything, we're just not going to be able to make it work, well, then I think you have to do what the Lions did with Matthew Stafford and basically announce this guy's available, get your offers in, because I think we would just see an unprecedented offers in terms of what teams would be willing to give up for Deshaun Watson. So I think the Texans really, that's the question they have to ask themselves and get figured out here really in the next couple of weeks, because you don't want this thing dragging into September where all of a sudden the guy's willing to sit out games and you've got nothing for him and you've got no solution at quarterback.
Well, I got to be honest, I got sick to my stomach when I saw your destination for Deshaun Watson, because you put him in San Francisco with Kyle Shanahan and the Hawks are in deep, deep trouble. Do you still feel that that's a number one option for him if he does go someplace?
Well, you know, I was just looking at the different teams, and obviously there would be so many teams that would be interested. Carolina, you know, I think they would give up a massive haul for Deshaun Watson. I know Miami has been the rumored team, and they've got tremendous assets. The team I kept coming back to where I said, you know what, if I were like the GM or the owner, I would have a hard time seeing a price that I deemed too much to get Deshaun Watson because of what you just said. I mean, if you team up Deshaun Watson at this age, at 26 years old, on a very team-friendly contract, by the way, for whichever team trades for him, you team him up with Kyle Shanahan, like, you can figure everything else out. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you might not have a great defense. It might take a step back. You might not have the best weapon at receiver. But, man, if that's the foundation you're working from for, like, the next 5 years, maybe longer than that if it works, the next decade, then I just feel like you're going to be in the mix for Super Bowls in most years. So I don't know if the 49ers feel the same way I do. You know, I think a lot of these teams are a little bit more risk-averse, and they want to make sure they get the right deal. But, man, that would just be a very tempting acquisition if I were the 49ers and Watson were available.
You've heard the comments from Russell Wilson. He's tired of getting hit so often, and he wants to be more involved with organizational decisions. What was your reaction? Of course, we're doing a lot of chatter out here, but the view from 30,000 feet on a national level, what was your thoughts when you read and saw those?
Yeah, I thought it was strange because, you know, I was there in Seattle 2015 and 2016, and those offensive lines were much worse than the offensive line he played for this year. And so I was surprised that that was kind of where the criticism came from. And I think in the past, he's done a pretty good job of, you know, not, I don't know if it's throwing teammates under the bus, but really not criticizing his teammates. And certainly he's got to be accountable for, you know, taking some of those sacks. A lot of people, whether it's X's and O's people or analytics people, will tell you that certainly quarterbacks are responsible for some of that. So I thought it was an odd comment. I do think in the last 2 years, you know, certainly he's felt a little bit more empowered with his public comments, whether it's just like he's feels like he's reaching a stage in his career where he wants his voice to be heard and he knows he's not going to be playing forever. And he's watching other teams get to the Super Bowl and the Seahawks haven't gotten past the divisional round, I think, since 2014. Maybe he's feeling a sense of urgency. And then the other thought I had was just, you know, looking at New England with Belichick and Brady, and like, you know, after a long time together, there are going to be disagreements and arguments about how things should be done, about how things are done. It's just natural when you're kind of working with somebody for that long. And so to me, you know, maybe that's just part of it. He's been there a long time now since he was drafted, and they've had stability where he's been working with the same people and talking to the same people day in and day out, and maybe they don't see eye to eye on how to bring the next Lombardi trophy to Seattle. So it really could be kind of a combination of all those different things.
What was interesting to me was just kind of the different level of hysteria. I mean, it seemed like the national guys kind of went to DEFCON 1 or 2 pretty quickly, whereas the local guys were more, yeah, this is a story, but... And is that kind of par for the course? Because you covered the Seahawks locally, and now you cover the NFL nationally. Is that kind of par for the course where the national guys might read a little bit too much into statements that are made?
I think that's right. I think when it comes to this time of year, February, and it's like, you know, there are no games, and, you know, there are going to be things that get talked about when a player of Russell Wilson's caliber speaks up about something like that. And, you know, to be fair, I think it was a little bit out of character, too, you know, to say something like that this offseason. So that's another reason why I think it maybe caught people off guard. So I think you're right. You know, I think September will roll around, and Russell Wilson will be on the Seahawks, and next year will come, and they'll be back in the playoff mix, and they'll be competitive every week because they've had that high floor really every season since Russell Wilson has been there. But at the same time, you know, I wouldn't sweep it totally under the rug because of some of the things I said. You know, if they have another season where they're not getting out of the first round of the playoffs, then that frustration from whichever side is only going to intensify. And when they have to determine, all right, who's the reason or what's the reason why we haven't advanced further than we want to, you know, the reasons for that could differ when you talk to Pete Carroll or John Schneider or Russell Wilson or other people in the organization. And so that would be natural to cause a little bit of friction there.
Let's stay with quarterbacks in the division. What is, from your understanding, the state of discontent that Kyle Shanahan may have with Jimmy Garoppolo? What about these rumors that Bill Belichick might want to try and reacquire Garoppolo? What do you see happening in San Francisco?
Yeah, I think the 49ers have to do something, and it's one of two things. I mean, one would be to take a real swing on a starting quarterback. But if you look at it right now and you kind of survey the market, unless a guy like Watson becomes available, there's no longer like that absolute guy where you say this guy would be definitely better than Jimmy Garoppolo. So we'll see. Maybe there is a mystery guy out there that they target and bring on board. But I think their other option there is to really invest in that backup quarterback position, because when Jimmy Garoppolo has played, they've won a lot of games. And for the most part, you know, he's not an elite guy, but he's played pretty well. The problem has been he's missed, what, 23, 25 games over the last 3 years. And when he's been out, they've been a disaster with Nick Mullins and C.J. Beathard and those guys starting behind him. So there are some pretty intriguing backup options and guys who might not have a seat at the table in terms of a starting job, you know, whether it's Cam Newton or Jacoby Brissett or Ryan Fitzpatrick. I mean, there's kind of a middle tier of quarterback there, guys who might not be guaranteed a starting job anywhere in the NFL, but, you know, could certainly be big upgrades in terms of backups. And so that wouldn't surprise me if the 49ers say, let's give it another run with Garoppolo. Let's hope that he can stay healthy this year, but let's make sure we protect ourselves in the event that he goes down, that we have a better backup option.
Sheil Kapadia joining us, national writer for The Athletic, talking NFL football. And you were mentioning Miami as a potential destination for Deshaun Watson. I want to talk about the Dolphins because I think they're really intriguing. And do you think they're close enough to Super Bowl contention that they might just say, hey, we're ready except at the quarterback position, so we got to do something there?
Well, I think you certainly saw, you know, when the head coach is making moves and pulling Tua out of games and putting Ryan Fitzpatrick into games like a relief pitcher, I mean, that does tell you a lot about what he thought the issues were. And it wasn't unfair. You know, I thought Fitzpatrick came in at times for them and really played better than Tua, and it was pretty obvious. So I don't know that the roster is like a Super Bowl caliber roster right now. I think it's competitive. I think Flores is a very good coach. I've been very impressed with him over the past 2 years. And so I think if you're Miami, you look at the landscape of the AFC and you say, all right, we know who the team is to beat. It's that Andy Reid, Patrick Mahomes, and the Kansas City Chiefs. How are we going to build a team that can year in and year out compete with those guys? You know, it's no longer just about being 9-7 and 10-6 and sneaking into the playoffs. I think they are entering a bit of a different phase. And so if you team up Deshaun Watson with Brian Flores, I mean, I think that is a very nice head coach quarterback combination where you can say, all right, now we can build around these two guys. We can figure some other things out. Flores is a very good defensive coach, so maybe you can scheme things up without necessarily investing a lot of money on that side of the ball. And so that's got to be appealing for them. And if the Texans are going to give up on Deshaun Watson or put him out there on the open market, you know, that's a situation where you could say, all right, maybe we get Tua, we get the number three overall pick, we get two more first round picks. Like, that could end up being the most attractive package that they get. So yeah, I think if he were available, Miami would certainly be a team to watch.
We're Sheil throwing Kapadia topics out.
Go ahead, Hugh. I'm sorry about that.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, Sheil Kapadia with us, and we're throwing our topics. Is there something that's moving your needle in terms of an opinion or a prediction or what have you? What's kind of top of mind for you?
Yeah, you know, I'm really interested in, and normally I have fatigue with this team, so it's a surprise that I'm saying that, but the New England Patriots this offseason, I do think it's a very interesting natural experiment, because what we're going to find out is, you know, if you were to ask Bill Belichick, hey, how would you build a team sort of from scratch in the year 2021? Well, we're kind of going to find that out this offseason, because they've got a lot of cap space where they can go in a number of different directions. They've got a higher draft pick than they've had in a very long time. They are not committed to a starting quarterback. And so just kind of the football nerd in me in terms of, hey, this team building, where do teams invest their resources? Do they build from the secondary up to the defensive line, or do they build the lines of scrimmage first and then figure other things out? Like, all those things I think are interesting in terms of how Belichick is going to do it this offseason. And they really can be a wild card that can kind of throw a wrench into some of these plans, these other teams' plans, because, like I said, they've got flexibility this offseason with their cap that a lot of other teams do not have.
The Seahawks currently don't have a lot of flexibility. That could change with roster cuts. That could change with contract restructures by Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner. So before we let you go, Shield, give us your bold prediction for the Seahawks. A player or two that you think has got a reasonable shot of coming to Seattle this offseason.
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, pass rush is the one that comes to mind, certainly. Cornerback, they could upgrade there, but I wonder if they're going to invest a little bit in somebody who can help them in the intermediate passing game. So I'll give you a bold one from a guy here in Philadelphia, where I live, a guy that's going to be available, and that's Zach Ertz, the tight end for the Eagles. You know, if the Seahawks are looking for a tight end who can make plays on third down, make plays in the red zone, kind of a veteran guy who's been part of a Super Bowl winning team, who's not going to cost a ton of money, I could see them making a push for a guy like Zach Ertz. You know, they made the move for Greg Olsen last offseason. It's still an area of need for them. They've got speed on the outside with Metcalf. They've got Lockett to stretch the field, but just that guy who can kind of work the middle of the field and, like I said, move the chains, help you on third down. He could be a guy to watch for Seattle.
Great stuff. Hey, Sheil, we thank you, and we'll continue to talk over the offseason.
Okay, good talking to you guys. Take care.
You bet. Shield Kapadia. Thanks, from The Athletic, a guy that you and I talked about yesterday, Hugh. Zach Ertz, I think it's kind of a natural fit for Seattle right now. A veteran guy that's smart, knows how to get open, you know, would be probably your number one target on a third and four or third and five situation.
Yeah, and we talked yesterday, I believe, was the Seahawks are 19th in their propensity to throw to tight ends in the league. They were 16th in terms of their effectiveness producing first downs, and then they were 26th in terms of yards per attempt. So you know, either at or below the median in all the important statistics regarding tight ends. Zach Ertz has been a bona fide top level tight end. I don't know what his health status is right now and what you get, but I still think he's young enough. I think he's a bright guy, you know, an instinctive guy. And I really think it's a position of necessity for Seattle, particularly as there's this chatter about going against the two high defenses, that most of which force you to throw more inside of the numbers and use the middle of the field the more. Well, obviously a tight end is going to specialize in that area. So I think that'd be a big upgrade for Russell Wilson to have that.
In the next segment, I want to talk to you about this passing game. And since this team has become Russ's team, since it's moved away from the LOB, away from a Marshawn Lynch-centric offense, and to Russell Wilson's team, obviously there has been a massive lack of success in the postseason. Pretty much similar success in the regular season, but a lack of success in the postseason. I want to get to the reasons behind that. Coming up next with Hugh Millen on 950 KJR.
And say big at Staples.
Now back to Softy and Dick on your home for March Madness and the Final Four. Seattle Sports Radio 950, KJR.
Less than an hour away from Textimonials. You got a question for Hugh Breedlove Millen, 49451. You like the idea of Zach Ertz coming to Seattle as Shield Kapadia? That was kind of his bold prediction. I asked him, give me one name. Give me one name of a free agent. Because you know a free agent's going to come to Seattle. We don't know the size of the name, but we know that somebody's going to come to Seattle. They pick up a free agent every year. Usually it's not a megastar. It's somebody kind of in the middle, like a Zach Ertz type of guy. What do you think about him potentially coming to Seattle? Softy and Dick without the soft one. Hugh Millen is here. And, you know, Hugh, I've been battling with the Let Russ Cook crowd all year long, as I'm sure you realize. And kind of the reason, the primary reason behind it is I'm trying to think back over the last, really go back to Dan Marino, when all they did was pass and they had no running game and he could never get over the hump. He went to one Super Bowl, didn't win it, never even got back to the Super Bowl. And I'm trying to remember the time outside of, you know, I guess the Patrick Mahomes 2019 team is an example of a pass-first, quarterback-dominated team that won a Super Bowl. But for the vast majority of teams, it has not been the superstar MVP-caliber quarterback throwing the ball a ton that gets it done and goes all the way and wins a Super Bowl. Is that, am I misreading that, or is that kind of your sense as well?
No, I tend to disagree with you, okay. Dick. I think that that certainly when you just take offense and defense, there's an old saying, you know, defense wins championships. Well, over the last 30 Super Bowls, 22 of them, that's 73%, had a dominant offense, okay, where you could describe – offense and defense both dominant. That was nine winners. There's 13 winners that had a dominant offense without a dominant defense, and there was only five that had a dominant defense with a weak offense. Most recently, when the Broncos won against Carolina. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I know you're talking about more about pass. My sense is that the most of those Super Bowl winners, those offenses, they are what could at least be deemed quarterback-centric teams. Now, Tom Brady's going to kind of muck up a lot of the statistics because you're going to have to decide what the Patriots were and what they've been with Tom Brady because he has seven of these doggone wins. So when
right,
you start
right.
categorizing that. But I think when you look at just in this decade, you've got Yeah, Drew Brees, certainly that's a quarterback-centric heavy pass defense, right? You have then you had the Packers with Aaron Rodgers. Now we can talk about how good the defenses were, but as an organization, how did they feel? Was the quarterback of the hub of the wheel? I would submit to you that in both of those cases, mm-hmm. The answer is yes.
That's fair.
Then you had the Giants beat the Patriots. That was with Eli Manning, and they were a heavy pass team. I mean, they barely ran the ball. You know, they obviously had a solid defense. The best part of that team was probably their front four.
Right.
But offensively, Eli Manning was throwing it. I mean, that wasn't the 1990 Giants that beat the Bills. Right.
Yeah.
With Jeff Hostetler. So that was a Eli Manning, you know, heavy pass team. Then you had, from there you had the Ravens. That was with Joe Flacco. He went on that incredible run. In fact, the four playoff games, it was the only four-game stretch in Joe Flacco's entire NFL career, we had four games with a passing rating over 100, four consecutive
That's
games.
Amazing.
And it just happened to be those playoffs and the Super Bowl. Then of course, he had the Seahawks in 2013. Then it came back to the Patriots. And again, you tell me, Tom Brady, he's thrown for a lot of yards. He's been an MVP, you know, multiple time league MVP. There's never been a team where they've won this. You know, the only time they weren't dominant in the Super Bowls throwing the football was that one they won against the Rams. And even at that, do you know that prior to this year, Tom Brady, of course, has seven Super Bowl wins. Mm-hmm. Prior to this most recent one, the six wins that he had were all what the NFL officially tabulates as a game-winning drive. Tom Brady had game-winning drives in all six of his Super Bowl wins.
But would you consider these teams, I mean, you mentioned a couple of them that were pass first, but I mean, are we talking about teams that are throwing it 60%+ of the time and winning Super Bowls?
Well, I'd have to look
at
those.
You can have a great quarterback like Tom Brady, like Aaron Rodgers, like Drew Brees, but what I'll remember from that Drew Brees championship team is that Drew Brees championship team, I feel, was much more balanced than those Drew Brees teams where he was throwing for 6,000 yards and they were going 8-8 because they were losing every game 41-37.
Yeah, I don't know what the percentages were then. I've always felt like Drew Brees was
I think it's just two different conversations though. One conversation is does a elite quarterback help you win a Super Bowl? Yes, an elite quarterback helps you win a Super Bowl, but my question is, does an elite passing game being the best part of your team? Or the part of your team that you rely on the heaviest to succeed, do those type of teams win the Super Bowl? And I'm just sure that they do.
Okay, so you just asked the question about that Saint team. First
yeah.
of all, that the one time Brees won a Super Bowl, they were number one in offense and number 25 in defense.
Okay.
In terms of yards, number 20 in terms of points.
Okay.
The defense. So they were number one in offense in both points scored and yards amassed.
Okay.
They were 25th defensively in yards, 20th in points. In passing, for yards, they were fourth. Defensively, they were 26th. Passing touchdowns, they were first okay. in the NFL. The next year with Green Bay, when they won it, that was Aaron Rodgers' lone time. Their offense was ranked. Now, that was a wild card team.
That's right.
Yeah. As far as yards, Aaron Rodgers was third in the league in yards. He was second in the league in attempts, second in touchdowns. You know, I mean, if you're top three in all those stats,
yeah,
you could be described as a pass heavy team. I just feel like the majority of the Super Bowl winners are featuring quarterback centric teams. Not all, mm-hmm. not all. Majority doesn't mean all, but I would say more than 50%. I would hold to that statement that it is more defensible to say that that offenses win championships, not defense. And it is more defensible to say that quarterback-centric teams, however you want to reasonably define that, it is more accurate to say that teams are win Super Bowls when they are quarterback-centric.
And I want to ask you, when we come back after the top of the hour headlines, if we're moving in the right direction in the NFL, and I'll explain what I mean next on 950 KJR.